Today, as part of the podcast interviews conducted on Radio Merseyside by LSTM, we have invited Professor Nick Beeching, Emeritus Professor of Tropical and Infectious Diseases, Senior Lecturer in Infectious Diseases at the School of Medicine, University of Liverpool, and Consultant in Tropical and Infectious Diseases at the Royal Liverpool University Hospital. He is also a co-director of the Liverpool site in the International GeoSentinel Network, the Global Emerging Infection Sentinel Network, and co-editor of one of the main reference books for the courses conducted at LSTM, which is Lecture Notes, Tropical Medicine. Professor Beeching, thank you for taking the time to participate in this podcast, and I hope as students, we can learn from your extensive experience in the field. Let me ask you, how did your interest in tropical medicine first arise?
Good morning, Leah. Thanks for allowing me to join you. I've always had an interest in biology. So I think my interest started probably in quite early childhood. But at school, we had some inspiring biology teachers, and a lot of people in my class went on to medicine, something like 10%, which we thought was ordinary at the time, but looking back was a bit unusual. And then my interest was cemented when I went to medical school very early on. It was obviously going to be infectious and tropical medicine. It's just too exciting.
That sounds exciting. And how do you think continuing to work intensively as a clinician has influenced you as a lecturer?
I think as a lecturer, as somebody doing teaching, I think it's really important to be actively practicing as a clinician. If you're going to give clinical lectures, you can draw on your day-to-day experience. And of course, it works both ways. If you've got to lecture, you have to know what you're talking about. And as soon as you start giving lectures, you realize you don't know what you're talking about, and you have to go and read up the subject and work out what the real questions are. And that feeds back into being a good clinician. So it works both ways. But I think it's much more fun for the lecturer, and probably hopefully much more fun for the students, if you can use examples from your everyday practice. And it focuses your mind on what the real questions are at the bedside and what students have to focus on in a vast amount of information.
Yes, indeed. I found it very interesting when you were giving the lectures. And how do you think your experience teaching abroad has influenced you? What was your favorite experience, for example?
Yeah, so I do quite a lot of, I've been involved in lots of conferences or some bedside teaching when I visit overseas, as well as experience teaching when I was working in the Middle East. I had sort of teaching responsibilities there. So I think the first thing is appreciating that we use a lot of abbreviations and acronyms in every country, and we all think they're the right ones. And I learned very fast that I didn't understand American ones, and Americans didn't understand ours. And of course, it's a nightmare for people who don't speak English. And so one of the first things you learn coming to speak at the school, actually, we all have to learn, is to get rid of all the abbreviations on our slides and spell things out, and be prepared to explain what the terms mean. So I think it's really simple things like that help. Obviously, working in different places overseas gives you a different perspective on how infections present, or any conditions present differently. And one of the joys of being on the course is there's always one of the students who has far more experience than me. And it's wonderful when a student stands up and says, actually, I looked after 1,000 cases of that last year during an outbreak somewhere around the world, and we can get the student to teach me. So, and I think that's really one of the joys of doing the residential course in person, as opposed to doing stuff online.
That's correct. I think having lectures online does change things. And it's interesting what you say about the abbreviation. I'm going to ask you a bit of a different topic now. How do you think the concept of tropical medicine and of tropical disease have evolved since the beginnings of your professional experience?
It's changed a lot. I think when I started, we still had this very traditional concept of it's an almost colonial medicine concept from the West, of the colonial powers going to work in or take over countries in Africa or India or wherever, and inevitably those countries then experienced illness in their personnel when they went overseas. And so it's a view of tropical medicine as being exotic, parasitic, or other kinds of infections that you might bring back to the UK or acquire overseas. And so the focus was, when I did the diploma, I'm just trying to work out, over 40 years ago, anyway, we'll leave it at that. There was a big focus, quite rightly, on prevention and sanitation and epidemiology, and that holds true today. But there was also a very strong focus on entomology, insects and vectors, parasitology, and much of the medicine, not all of it that we were taught, focused on just infectious disease. And that was the concept of an exotic illnesses. Now I think we have a much wider view of illness in resource poor settings, which encompasses non-infectious problems as well. And I hope the teaching in the school reflects that. The epidemiology, public health control, still a major focus, and that was one of the things I learned anyway 40 years ago. But the school has specialists in respiratory medicine in the tropics. We have a marvellous tradition, or certainly in the last 20 or 30 years, of first of all paediatrics in the tropics, and then leading on from that, maternal health in the tropics. And the school's contributed enormously. And that's really not infectious at all. It's dealing with fundamental issues of importance to women everywhere. So I think that kind of broadening out, even from the Liverpool focus, it has been very obvious to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And do you think there could be a broader approach to the concept?
I think there is, because global health has become very trendy now. I think a lot of people, it means different things to different people. To me, global health means equity everywhere. And that doesn't mean exotic infections and stuff, but some people still think of it that way. It has become a bit of a bandwagon for a lot of universities, I think. Sort of think that's great, there might be some money in that. And so I think getting some agreement of what it means across the board will be helpful. I think we do think that way, and we will continue to embrace those principles, but it's one of the fundamental things the school does, is to try and improve the health of people in resource poor settings. That's in our mission statement somewhere. And that is global health to me.
You mentioned global health, which you're right, very trendy now. LSEM does offer courses not only in Liverpool but also outside the UK, for example through partnership with the Ghana College of Physicians and Surgeons, Save the Children. What has your experience as your lecturer taught you about schools in other places? Do you think it's possible, and do you think it's beneficial for people in those settings?
Yeah, I think it depends who it's aimed at. So, for example, our colleagues in London started a DTMNH course in East Africa, which is very popular. They've been doing that for some years now, and part of that is aimed very much at what I would call Western young doctors who want that teaching experience in a clinical environment, in this case in Africa. And part of the commitment of the students is they pay a bit extra so that their African colleagues can join the course. And that's an admirable concept, and is very popular. There are some practical issues. It's very expensive to run such courses. Lecturers and senior lecturers don't come cheap. And if you're going to run a residential course somewhere overseas, there are very practical issues if you want to keep the cost down. So I think that's for the benefit primarily of young Western doctors going overseas. We have in the recent past run 2-week add-ons in Malawi. Now, I wasn't involved in that, but again, they're very popular for Liverpool students. Didn't cost so much. I'm not sure how much good it did the Malawians, So, and then you start to talk about, is this health tourism or is it really teaching? And I think it's important to remember that people descending on another country for teaching experience, it is a little bit like tourism. There's a wonderful course in Peru, which I sort of thought I might treat myself to going on because I have no experience of working there, the Gorgas course. But everybody who's been on it says it's wonderful. There's a lot of bedside teaching. The students teach each other a lot as well. Both faculty and the young doctors going. And you see such a wide range of conditions in situ. And I think that's possibly a bit more embedded in the way they practice there. And I think that would be a nice sort of thing to do. Really, I would like to see the medical school in Malawi setting up its own course. That I think it should be taught by people who are, you know, who know what they're talking about in the country they're from. And in the past, Liverpool School has helped set up such schools. For example, the School of Tropical Medicine at Mahidol University in Thailand was set up with great assistance from the school, and we have a long-standing relationship with them. And there are other courses which probably, other places which started more as colonial schools, like the one in Kolkata in India, but that's now entirely the responsibility of, obviously, of Indian physicians, quite rightly. And I would like to see a little bit more of that coming up. If I was a Malawian, I'd say, well, why do we need a course in tropical medicine in Malawi? It's part of our everyday medicine. And it comes back to that, your original question of what is tropical medicine if you come from the tropics and live in the tropics? So the viewpoint as a European is probably very different from somebody who's actually from a tropical country and lives and works there.
That's true. I mean, what you say is absolutely correct. Like, we need to make sure that it's not only an opportunity for the people who go there to learn, the Westerners, but also for the people who live there. And I wanted to ask you as well about field work, for example, in MSF. We know field workers, for example, must be able to cope with difficult and unpredictable environment and adapt to the local culture and living conditions. How do you think students who attend two courses in LSTM would be better prepared for such an experience?
Well, when I came to do the diploma here, and I worked as a junior doctor for the school for 6 months, my mentor at the time, Dr. Dion Bell, said the most important thing you need to learn to work in the tropics is how to take apart a Land Rover and put it together again. There was nothing to do with tropical medicine. So I think it's really important to be prepared for working in a different culture, working in a different physical environment than you're used to. It might be hotter or sometimes colder, living with potentially less resources or limited resources like water and electricity and so on. And also the culture shock of coming back to home. Everybody gets excited about going to work away. When you come back, nobody's interested at all. And that's a big shock. And people don't think about the difficulties of coming back. And we've seen it so many times. And I reckon it takes at least a month per year overseas, if not more, to readapt to living. It took me a year when we came here from the Middle East in 1987, which is before the internet existed, to cope with the idea that you could send a letter to somebody and it would get there the next day and you'd get a reply back in the post 2 days later. I was used to a 1 month turnaround if you were lucky. So simple things like that are very different. But it can be very difficult being sort of on your own you probably won't be alone. They have lots of people helping you, but being alone culturally in some ways. And many of the NGOs are now much better than they were when I first started in this area at preparing people for that sort of thing, preparing them for the stresses of working very hard and feeling guilty if you don't go on working hard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because you're the only person there, and other potential pressures because what's happening to your family at home, if you've got elderly parents, what's happening, what about your partner, if you have other dependents like children. There's lots of other things to worry about. So I think it is important to think through those practicalities. And as I say, most of the NGOs do now prepare Westerners to go and do that sort of thing.
That's right. I think some NGOs require that you have at least 3 months experience volunteering abroad, because having a short experience abroad prepares you for a longer one. Just it's easier to start with a short one. Do you think so?
Yeah, so I think it's great if as a medical student you get a chance to do an elective overseas. That might be a rather rose-tinted view of it, but that's what really set me going. I did my elective in South India, and I knew absolutely nothing about India before I went. I'd never been there. I didn't know anything about Indian food, and it was wonderful. And I've had a love affair with India and Sri Lanka and Pakistan ever since, because the people were wonderful, the food was wonderful, the medicine was fascinating, but there were some big culture shocks as well, you know, learning to face poverty everywhere at the same time and the contrasts. So I think you at least you have some concept of what that's like, and we were well looked after, but our living conditions were very basic compared to what I was used to at home. And that gives you a chance to find out whether that excites you, or whether actually you prefer to have air conditioning and fridges and a ready supply of everything you're used to. I think if you have a chance to do a short tour before taking on a long contract, it's a really good thing. And it's also important for your partner to have been there, because, you know, you might be full of enthusiasm, but if your partner's never been and lived that reality, especially if they have a job but then go to not having a job, that's a major source of stress for people as well, as couples. So a little bit of toe in the water before signing up for a longer thing is great. Also, I think talking to people who've worked where you're going to find out what it's really like is important if you can.
Yes, it's very interesting. I think that would help. And also, I was going to ask you more broader questions, but we sort of answered part of it already. Where do you think the major challenges rely for students in tropical medicine? And how do you see the future of teaching in tropical medicine? Do you see anything changing at all in our concepts or in our way of teaching?
Well, the teaching is evolving. I think the first thing is, you know, obviously online teaching has evolved a lot. It's been developing for last 15 years, but because of the COVID pandemic, it's been forced upon us. And a lot of us are still learning how to do that effectively. I think one of the joys of teaching at the school is you're just surrounded by wonderful teachers. And I love going to my colleagues' teaching thing, because most of us love doing it. And most of my colleagues are wonderful. And you just watch and learn different teaching styles. People like Professor Bertie Squires and Professor Malcolm Molyneux tell wonderful stories, and you just remember it, and people that taught me when I was there. So I think that live teaching, how we can convey that excitement and still involve people online, is a challenge. Keeping it interactive and making the most of the experiences of the students on the course, because this is a postgraduate course, I think is a challenge. So just the actual delivery is one challenge. I think it's that change in focus. Are you wanting to learn about the minutiae of managing and preventing malaria with an academic hat on, perhaps to go on and do a PhD and become a professor of tropical medicine, which is very different from preparing somebody to go and work in a rather basic hospital and provide leadership for a whole bunch of medical and non-medical professionals and non-professionals in a resource poor setting is very different.
Yes, that's very true.
So we try and do both.
Yeah, exactly. And that led me actually to the next question with it, which is how do you think both kinds of students, so there are students who have finished training in tropical medicine to apply the knowledge in UK practice, in contrast with students who will apply it abroad, and how you think they would apply differently. But I think you already mentioned that. I mean, if you want to expand more on the question.
Yeah, so I think, for example, a lot of infectious disease trainees in the UK will do the diploma. You can do courses outside the school, which are not residential, just to sort of make you do the book learning. I don't think that's nearly so exciting and so much fun, but it's cheaper and more practical for people who are already busy. And so, you know, it's good that more people want to learn about it. So I think if you want to do that sort of thing, that is an excellent background. But I think those that are going on to have a career, let's say, I'm talking rather generally, let's say in the WHO or in major international organizations or in the field with organizations such as MSF, I think they need to get that experience. My advice would be to have a short period, up to a year, see if you like it. And then if you like it, you have to think about, where do I want to end up in 20 years time? Do I want to come back and be a general practitioner? Do I want to come back and be a public health expert, which is the thing that's going to make the most difference to people in the world? And then try and weave postgraduate training for those specialties into your experience. And when I started 40 years ago, there wasn't a very good career structure for those people. And a lot of people still work at a senior level on ridiculous 6-week temporary contracts with international organizations. And that there's no security in that for somebody. It's all right when it's not even all right when you're 25, but it's certainly not all right when you're 50 and you have a house and family to support. But I think it's finding a career structure that will support you and organizations that will support you and make sure you have those opportunities for reflection and continual professional development, and trying to obtain qualifications that let you work as a specialist at such time as you decide you want to come back home, in inverted commas, if you're a Westerner.
That's true. And a lot of perspective that I wasn't really thinking about that. And I think a lot of us were not thinking about that when we start the course. We think about the next 5 years, but not.
I advise people to find a sort of fairy godfather or a fairy godmother, somebody senior who knows roughly what you're doing and can give you some advice about and a bit of support, and maybe know somebody who can help you, you know, if you're going somewhere, but actually somebody that can just keep an eye out for opportunities back home. And here I'm talking again about Westerners going to work in a tropical setting. But also talk through with you, and I can't overemphasize the importance for partner and family, what your long-term plans might be. And most people don't know what their long-term plan is, but they might know what they don't want to do. And make sure you don't fall into that trap. You want to keep as many avenues open for as long as possible, career-wise. But in my experience, the three things that disrupt more than 50% of our young tropical doctors' career paths are partner issues, just unhappiness one way or another, people being left at home or going out to work and perhaps doing voluntary work that they were being paid a lot of money for at home, feeling taken for granted. And it's usually the woman, to be honest, or it has been historically, going out to follow their male partner. But times are changing, so it works either ways. Whose career is going to be sacrificed if you can't work? What effects it have on them? The second thing is illness in your parents and family. You know, if you're 25 or 30, your parents are probably getting a bit ancient like me, and bad things happen. And chronic illness or death in a parent is a very common reason for people to come home, especially if you feel guilty if your siblings are looking after ill relatives at home. And people don't sort of think about that. And you need to talk about that with your own family, about what might happen if you're in somewhere where it's difficult to come home. And then, of course, there's children. And people always think that schooling in their country is the best. I think it's very good for small children to have different experiences and hopefully learn to speak languages, which they'll do much better than their aging parents. And I'm sure it doesn't matter where you go to school until you're at least 10, to be honest. But that often features, and possibly risk to health of children if you're working in an environment where there's a lot of risks, and you might take those risks with your own health, but not with young children. So these are all very practical family issues that you need to think through a bit before you go and work somewhere where access to medical care, if you have a bad car accident, which is my biggest worry, or catch some horrible infection, is not available.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with academic stuff. It's the reality of everyday life.
Yeah, that's so true. And there's so many things that we have to consider before going. And I think that's why organizations such as MSF, they ask so many questions before you embark in such a journey. I'm going to take you a bit to another topic now, which is COVID pandemic and how it has affected, and we already mentioned how it has affected the teaching because it has forced us to go online in many aspects that probably we wouldn't have. Also, we are now more aware of how the higher prevalence of a disease in one country may affect other countries and the world almost inevitably. And I think in tropical medicine, I would like you to think about how in tropical medicine is concept can be applied to other conditions or diseases. And we kind of talked about that during the course as well. Mm-hmm. And how and which disease is going to be applied to and why?
Well, you know, we've known this is going to happen for decades. It's been in lots of books. It's been talked about at high level for a long time. You know, our big warning was SARS nearly 20 years ago now, I think. And at the time in Britain, we thought, well, thank goodness SARS never came here. Same thing, but more lethal, if you like. But we've known the concept. We have known as specialists in infection and epidemiologists that something like that affects the whole world very fast, and that it is both morally correct and also selfish to actually, for Western countries, well-resourced ones, to support our colleagues internationally, because what happens in Angola can happen in the UK the next day and so on. There's no borders for these problems. And it's very frustrating to many of us that a lot of the discussions that happened around Ebola 6 years ago after Ebola, where it showed how much the world's economy and how the economy of West African countries could be destroyed by a potentially international problem. There was lots of talk about setting things up, but it never really achieved what it should have done. And I hope that the experiences of COVID won't be forgotten as the bigger problems associated with it settle down, and they're nowhere near that yet, and that enough resources and political resources, not just the money, it's the political will and resources to strengthen healthcare systems in resource-poor settings for early diagnosis and management and provide adequate person power for prevention and control and vaccines or whatever is appropriate is in place for the next thing, because it's inevitable we're going to have other pandemics. Something that's spread by the respiratory route coming from the eastern part of the world, from our perspective, has been what's predicted, and I'm 75% sure that's what the next one will be. Whether we have other bloodborne problems, that's quite likely too, but it's the person-to-person rapid respiratory spread infections are the biggest threat.
And the world will continue to be globalized, and they will continue to travel around the world and go on missions and be affected, I think, like you said, by political will and by the investment of the local government. I wanted to ask you as well about talking about investment and political will. How do you think the latest cuts announced by the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office would affect, if anything, the teaching and training of professionals in tropical medicine?
Well, first of all, I think the cuts are immoral It's as simple as that. I'm not a great, jingoistic British person, but one of the things I was proud of was that we set an example to some of our other richer nation colleagues in setting aside what we said we would as budget for overseas. And one of the things that Britain is still has still been good at is setting that leadership role internationally and encouraging other countries to do that. And I think it's, personally, I think it's outrageous that we should cut that budget or repurpose it for more politically oriented use of money. And I really hope that, nothing to do with the teaching of the school, I just think it's wrong. And we should maintain that because that is something we're good at. As far as the school's activities, it's a nightmare because so many of our programs working with colleagues overseas depend on that background support. And building up links with colleagues and maintaining them overseas takes years and years and years. And it can be broken in 5 minutes by, building up that level of mutual trust and exchange of personnel at all levels. And having the rug pulled out from under you, having succeeded in what is often a very competitive bidding process for resources, is awful, because if we lose those links, it will take years to build them back up. It's not just a matter of switching the tap back off and back on again. So I hope that the government can be persuaded to change its mind over that. And of course, there are MPs on all sides trying to achieve that, and I wish them every success.
Thank you. Thank you for answering all the questions. And it was long, and I really appreciate you sharing your experience and your vast knowledge in the topics that we discussed.
It's always a pleasure, and it is always a pleasure talking to enthusiasts like you from all over the world. So I wish you all the best in the future as well.
Thank you.